accession number 22352, reel 3.
Graham Swain, reel 3. We were on the banks of the River Senio in the winter of 1944, and we were stuck there for almost 3 months. The Senio was a narrow river, but with high flood banks each side, roughly 30 feet in height. And the proximity to the Germans at that time was sometimes less than 20 yards. They were on their backside of the flood bank, and we were on our backside of the flood bank. You could hear talking and rattle of mess tins and all that sort of thing, and it was akin to the First World War conditions, static, with everybody taking pop shots at one another from time to time. There was one particular incident, well, I didn't witness this, but it was told there was a particular German officer full of bravado that rode a white horse along the top of this flood bank as a gesture of defiance. Nobody shot at him. It was one of those little things that you hear about, as you used to hear in the First World War, about troops playing football against one another. I didn't experience anything like that, but it was one of those things.
You mean there was a certain degree of forbearance?
Well, there was. By that time, I mean, the feeling was that if they don't start anything, we won't. But we knew we weren't going to get anywhere. We weren't going to shift off that until the spring came. And, of course, what you've got to remember is, as an infantryman, you don't know what's going on at all. You don't know what's going on, really, 20 miles down the road. It's only if you're a senior rank that you know who and what's going on. And, of course, the big push through what was called the Argenta Gap was being planned with the... Our particular part is a very large lake called Camacchio, which the lake itself is not too bad, but the Germans had flooded, removed all the flood barriers, and there was a very large area, I don't know how many square miles, of thick mud, and it was just absolutely not traversable at all. And they brought up these machines called fantails, which was a form of Sherman tank with no tops on, and they had some sort of propeller, and we actually boarded these things, went across the lake, and our particular battalion objective was Porto Maggiore, which was and my memory of that is stepping off the fantails into what was supposed to be hard ground, and I was down in about 6 feet of water, and I was carrying at the time an 18 radio set, which is a quite a large contraption, weighs about 20 pounds, but it was buoyant, and it helped me to float and get ashore. Of course, my number two, who was behind me with the microphone, when I went down into the water, the jack came out of the radio, and he's talking to nothing. And we get ashore, and as we did so, we became aware of a number of dead bodies there. And when we looked at them, we realised that they were British commandos. Number 24 Commando had been ordered to secure this length of ground called the Spit. And it is... one of the Royal Marines regimental honours, where a Lance Corporal Foster won the Victoria Cross in this particular action. But they, in fact, secured the piece of ground which we landed on. And then it was easier for us, because if they hadn't secured that, we would have been shot up as we were approaching.
What was it like being in a fantail?
Horrible, because... you were expecting a mortar to come down in the open top. We didn't really have a great faith that they would float, because we'd heard of the bad things on the second front, where some of the Shermans had gone straight under some of these allegedly floatable. They'd gone down. and I think they lost about 30 on one occasion. Of course, these rumours percolate through, and we thought, well, are these things going to be the same? Because we didn't know when we were over deep water or passing over the mudflats. It's a terrific area, but of course it was just water, and we just didn't know.
Did they have a fan tail? Did they have a fan tail?
Did who?
Did these boats have a fan tail?
No. That was they were called. I gather that at one stage in Western Europe they were called buffaloes, but in our theatre of war they were called fantails, because sometimes when we talk to people in the Normandy vets and talk about fantails, they don't know what you're talking about. But when you just, oh, you mean a buffalo? But once again, American. It was. Of course, by this time I'm in the Queen's Regiment. Between the period of leaving Anzio, and of course there was one other big battle, the final battle of the Ox and Bucks, which was before the Senio, was at a place called Germano.
Can you describe what happened to you there, please?
At Germano, which has subsequently been written up by an Italian professor as the Casino of the Adriatic. It was a small town on a hilltop which we just could not capture. And of course it had a vantage position, as did Casino. You couldn't get round it because it was a viewpoint. And there were about six attempts by various battalions to capture Germano. And at that time, I was still in the Ox and Bucks, and it was the last action that the Ox and Bucks took place in, because the casualties were so horrendous that the battalion was disbanded. And it was just a question of getting up to this small village, which is on the top of a mountain crag, and they could just pop us off as you try and take cover and get up. And the Ox and Bucks failed to take it on their attempt. And then there were two more attempts by the Queen's Regiment, which was running alongside us, before it was finally taken by the 27th Battalion after about 10 days fighting.
So what did you personally do at Germano?
I was a signaller, a foot slogger. Motorbikes weren't any good at Germano. I carried a signals, 18 set it was called.
So if the Germans were in such a strong position at Germano,
yes,
why did the army not just bypass it?
It held such a strategic position in terms of being able to view everything. It needed to be eliminated, as did Casino. It's exactly like Casino. Wipe it out, because they can see you for miles and miles. Bit like San Marino, which of course was supposedly not occupied, but it was, because the Gordon Highlanders went up and found the Germans up there. Because San Marino was, what do they call this?
Independent,
yeah.
How did you feel about transferring to Queen's Royal Regiment?
Sad. Because I've been an Ox and Bucks man, done a lot of fighting with it, but we had no say in the matter. The regiment is now disbanded, and you're Queen's man. And I went with my mate, Corporal Curly Collett, and I will say that the Queen's men welcomed us and did try and make us feel at home, knowing how they would have felt if they had been. Oh, they're quite a bit of camaraderie. How they would have felt if the Queen's had been broken up. And I was, once again, posted the signal platoon, because I was then a regimental signaller. But as soon as I let them know I could ride a motorbike, because I love motorbikes, I was appointed a DR. Dependent on the particular circumstances of the action, whether I rode a motorbike or whether I carried a radio.
Was it much different in the Queen's as compared with the Ox and Bucks?
Well, the only thing which was the drill, foot drill, of course. Light infantry drill is much, you march at 160 to the minute as opposed to 120, and the rifle movements are different, but no, other than that, it was just an infantry battalion.
You were talking about the Arctic conditions you were under on the senior.
Yes.
Did you have special clothing?
Only the white camouflage clothing. No, you've... The British Army battle dress serves you in Sierra Leone, in Africa, in Norway, just the one. We did have, in Egypt, khaki drill, the battle dress was all we had. For warmth, they did start issuing to the infantry leather jerkins, half jerkins, but nothing else. And bear in mind, a great coat, it isn't much good you scrambling around in the dirt, you know. You often used to see these Germans in Russia trying to walk, wearing great long heavy raincoats in those conditions, overcoats, you know. Very not conducive to movement. I didn't think about that, I suppose.
So, coming back to Camarchia,
yes.
You crossed it to capture Porto Maggiore.
Porto Maggiore, yes.
Did you? What happened when you tried to capture it?
Well, we beat our way into there. I mean, firing and as we go, and then the Germans retreating, and that was the start, of course, of the collapse of the campaign in Italy. Once we got through the Argenta Gap, whereas. In the past, we'd advance by yards. After Argenta, we were advancing by miles. And in fact, it was the first time that the Germans did start to surrender in any large numbers. And one of our companies, near a place called Rovigo, I think it was, I wasn't personally involved in this, did in fact capture a whole German engineer regiment, put their hands up, and quite honestly didn't know what to do with them. What do you do with some mass of German prisoners? In the meantime, of course, we're making our way along the coast. The 2nd New Zealand Division, the Kiwis, they led the assault, or led the advance into Venice, and were the actual first troops into Venice. First troops. We were the first, the Queens were the first British troops into Venice. And as soon as we had got there, the Germans had capitulated, except for the one place which was allocated to our battalion, which was the Lido. And the 27th Battalion went across on the, in fact, I think we used the Italian water buses to get across to the Lido. And the Germans there either hadn't heard or didn't wish to know that the war was over so far as they were concerned, and they started to take pop shots at us, and of course they were killed and put down. And I always remember this, we were allocated billets on the Lido, and we were sent to the Ungheria Palace Hotel, which I've since seen in the Thompson's magazine, Thompson's holiday, still there.
When you were in Italy and also in Egypt, what was the attitude of Italian civilians and Egyptian civilians towards you?
The average Egyptian was a wog and treated as such. They were not of our class of life. That was what we felt about them. They were wogs. When we first went to Italy, we thought we're dealing with wops, But as I said to you earlier, you really had to sort out who your friends were. And quite personally, I never believed anybody telling me anything until they could prove it to me. They were all very friendly now towards us. The war was over. The German Tedeschi, they called them Tedeschi Avanti. But you thought, buggers, if the Germans were here, you'd be saying, oh, Inglesi. So, really, I don't have any particular regard, or didn't have any particular regard for any Italian until I started to go back and meet the people who I now accept, for instance, I'm very friendly with, Professor Montemaghi, who is a noted Italian military historian, and we've eaten in his home and that sort of thing. And he said, has always said, that the campaign in Italy was largely like your Burma campaign. He said, it's forgotten, and never was a truer word spoken, because we entered Rome on the 4th of June 1944. And on the 6th of June, the Allies crossed the Channel. And from then onwards, Italy was on the back pages, and it didn't exist anymore. And we've always said we were forgotten like the Burma people. And it was one of the reasons why our association was formed, to try and, you know, say that Italy wasn't a land of sunshine and flowers. It was a scene of bitter fighting. More bitter fighting took place per acre in Italy than ever it did in France. We never don't denigrate what took place in France, but the type of fighting was much more personal, hand to hand, and that sort of thing. In France, where tanks were swishing across, we know all about the Arnhem bridges and all that, and great bravery by the Paras and all that there. But we'd had two and a half years of this before D-Day, and when people say D-Day, our association says, "Ah, which one do you mean, they? Pantelleria? Sicily, Salerno, Taranto, Anzio." Oh, there's five to start with, before you, or when you were still drinking in England. So we do get a bit bitter about it. I don't know if other people from Italy have told you this, or...
Yes, they have.
So we always do say, well, which D-Day do you want, mate? Pick anyone, and we'll tell you where we were then.
Did you run into the Yugoslavs in northeast Italy?
We're coming up to that. Of course, when the Germans in Europe capitulated, bear in mind they chucked their hand in Italy before they capitulated in Europe. We were in the city of Trieste, which, as you know, was previously been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and before the formation of Yugoslavia and all that sort of thing, it belonged to the Serbs. Well, on Victory in Europe night, when everybody was jugging it up in outside Buckingham Palace, we were actually stood to in the village of Opicina, which is just at the top of the hill above Trieste, armed and ready to fight the Yugoslavs, who were the other side, who were determined to come down and take over Trieste. And it was only bravado. I've spoken about our Colonel MacWilliam. He said, "We can't have this." He said, "Bring up a couple of wasps." And the wasps were Bren gun carriers adapted with flamethrowers. And he put these wasps across the village square in Opicina, not facing the Yugoslavs, and gave a couple of bursts from the wasps, and they realised that we meant business. They weren't going to push us off, and they withdrew. Well, then, as you know, there was a political settlement. Immediately, they formed a four-power police force to patrol the streets of. It was the French, the Americans, ourselves, and the Italians, and we were hard pushed. Trieste was a bit like Berlin. In the middle of Trieste, there's a tunnel, which leads to a tram tunnel, which sort of splits the town in two. And it was like an eastern and a western situation. And if any of the Triestini girls came across from the Yugoslav side to fraternise with British soldiers, they were treated like with a haircut, and all that sort of thing, tarred and feathered. The Serbs are a cruel lot, as history has subsequently shown. They did not like us because we were stopping them from getting into Trieste.
Were they literally tarred and feathered?
Yes.
Did you see it?
No. I mean, the girls on our side, I mean, we were then fraternising with them, Italian girls, and they would say, well, they won't come across from there because this is what will happen to them. They get their hair cut. And then, of course, we went down to a place called Pola, which is now Pula, a big, big resort. And we did, in fact, hold a big victory parade in Pula with, I forget what, I think it was Alexander came down and we all paraded on the village square. But the Yugoslavs started stringing wires across between Pula and Pola, between Trieste and Pola, it's about 80 or 90 miles. And of course, we had daily runs up there, motorcycles, trucks. Some of the Yugoslav partisans started actually stringing wire across the road to decapitate our people. And they were, we'd supposed to have fought the war for them. But as you know, Tito's history, communism was the big enemy at that time, and they were against us, and we were against them, and it was quite nasty to start with. But then it did in fact smooth down, and we remained on garrison duties in Trieste until the war was over, of course, and they then started to repatriate the troops. And myself being younger than a lot of people, I was age and service group. Do you know the term age and service group, by which people were admitted to the army and the date of release was determined? I was 48. And of course, the war in Japan, against Japan, was still in progress. And what they said, that anybody, a group 48 and over, is on a draft for the Far East. And they brought out from England to Trieste a battalion of the Royal Sussex Regiment, and I was posted to that, the 4th, 5th Battalion. I never fought the war with them, and we were standing by, waiting to go to Japan, of course, when they dropped the atom bomb, and the whole shebang was over. And so when anybody complains to me about the atom bomb being dropped in Japan, I say, well, good luck, because I'd have been out there. Because there is no doubt, if we had had to fight the Japanese on their own soil, the death roll would have been horrendous. So it didn't happen. So they didn't really know what to do with this Bakshi battalion. All the lads came out because they had white knees, and because we were all brown, and these kids, they'd just been called up, you see, they hadn't and ever seen an angry man. So the whole battalion was posted to Malta. The war was over, and we were on garrison duties in Malta, doing the governor's palace guard. Bullshit, you know.
How did you like that?
Loved it. I loved it.
Why?
Yeah. Oh, well, I'd been promoted to corporal by that time in the signal platoon. Oh, I like to see soldiers, on guard, formally, and I enjoyed it.
And you were on a holiday island?
Virtually it was a holiday. All right, we were on garrison duties, but there was nothing. And of course, the Maltese were very receptive to the British, had a lot of regard for the British, and of course that lasted well until Mintoff took over, and when he became all anti-British. And I came home for the first time since I went overseas. I came home from Malta, and I'd been courting my wife before. I mean, when in the army, we were engaged, and decided to get married. Went back to Malta, and then came home on a second leave, and got married in the UK.
And then where did you become a policeman?
In 1947, November 1947.
Whereabouts?
In Kent.
Whereabouts in Kent?
Gravesend. Never been there.
I have.
You see, it was silly. I'd always wanted to be a policeman. I'd lived my life in Bournemouth, formative years in Bournemouth, and the fire service and all this sort of thing. I did, in fact, have visions of going back to the fire service. But I'd always had an inkling to be a policeman, and by strange coincidence, my wife's mother had a very large house in Bournemouth, and she had single policemen as lodgers before the war. There were many, six or seven. And I always used to say, it's the best digs in Bournemouth, because she provides the best grub. so that popped the idea into my head. But of course, they had always said, well, they won't have you in Bournemouth. If you've been to school in Bournemouth, you must get away from, you know, they had the stupid idea that you'd show favouritism towards your mate. So I thought, well, I'll join. Where is it? Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll ask for Kent, because it's got Ramsgate, Margate, Dover, lovely, seaside. Where did I go? Gravesend. Cool, bloody awful place. And I stayed there almost a year, and at that stage it was utterly impossible to get accommodation, rented accommodation of any sort at all. The wages were £4, 5 shillings a week, and I managed to get two rooms with an old witch in Gravesend, and my wife came up, and we were paying her £2, 5 shillings a week for these two rooms, and we were living on £2, you know. And I said, oh, I can't have this. So we decided after a year she would go back to Bournemouth. And I thought, well, I'll have a go at getting into Bournemouth. Well, of course, what I didn't realise by that time, the Hampshire force was in charge of the Bournemouth area for policing. And then I happened to bump into a bloke. He said, dear, Southampton's a good police force. They're advertising for blokes. So I applied to transfer to Southampton, which I did. And I did 30 years in Southampton.
What was the law and order situation in places like Gravesend and Southampton after the war?
It was a bit rough. It was, you know, hundreds of returning merchant seamen who didn't give a damn. And you had to look after yourself. And, shall we say, summary jurisdiction often prevailed. But we had a good reputation in Southampton. Well, in fact, I used to say, if you step off the pavement in Southampton, you're nicked for drunk. Wasn't quite as bad as that, but we did establish a reputation. And we, of course, there had been a tremendous number of Yanks here during the war. I mean, prostitution was, God, every other bloody woman you could see was a prostitute in the high street. And the bottom end of the town, Southampton City, when I first came here, it was pretty rough. I mean, no bloke could walk down without getting accosted, and eventually they really had to do something about it, and we started to shepherd them, and gradually, of course, they all finished up in brothels in Derby Road and places like that. But it was there, and it was a way of life. And I had a good career. I enjoyed the police force.
And when you said earlier that people used to be arrested for swearing in the streets,
yes.
Is that correct?
Well, if they use obscene language, yes. I mean, there is, I can't say it on that, there's a story about...
Well, you can say it. There's a story about
an old, one of the big old beefy constables in Southampton named Justice Hawkins. And the stories abound about what he used to say. And one time he was asked to deliver a message to a lady to say that her husband had died in the hospital. And he knocked on the door and said, are you Widow Smith? I'm not a widow, he said, you are. But the other thing was, he arrested a bloke for obscene language in the street, did Justice, and the bloke said, I didn't swear, yes he did. So Justice gets up and the witness says, he called me a fucking bastard, your worships, 4 fucking times. Now that is legend, you know. But... people did get locked up for the F word, because it was not acceptable to ordinary people in those days. It is now. I mean, you hear it. I get embarrassed when I hear it with my wife sitting there. She knows what. She was a nurse in the war in Fleet and District Hospital, nursing troops. But I still don't like it.